Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired. And my co-host, Mike Calori, is out this week. So I was thinking maybe I would just monologue for 45 minutes, with some ad breaks, of course. No, I would not do that to you. I've actually invited our excellent health and science writers, Megan Multini and Adam Rogers, back on the show. Megan, Adam, thank you for being here. And of course, by here, I mean there at home.
Happy to be anywhere, but nice to see your face on the Zoom, as always.
Hello from my closet in Minneapolis. Glad to be here.
The reason why I wanted to bring Adam and Megan on the show this week is because we're in a strange phase of the coronavirus pandemic right now. After months of quarantine, cities and businesses are tentatively lifting restrictions and reopening around the world. But that, of course, doesn't mean the coronavirus has just gone away. And while essential workers have been interacting with people and exposing themselves to the virus for months now, for a lot of people, these lifts on restrictions mean that going places and seeing people is possible again, but with a lot of caveats. So people are starting to ask questions about how they should and shouldn't interact with other people. This episode was actually inspired by one of our own Wired colleagues who asked a question in Slack about a complicated family situation. So since Megan and Adam are two of our resident coronavirus experts, I've brought them on the show to help answer some of these questions. And we went a little bit longer than usual this week, but that's because so many of you sent in great questions, and honestly, there's no easy answer. All right, so the first batch of questions came to us through Wired's Instagram, and then later on in the show, I'm going to get to our staff questions, and we're actually going to have some people calling in. First question from Instagram. Do I need to wear a mask all the time when I go out?
Here's the logic with the mask. The logic is it's a respiratory virus, and the way that you transmit, there are a few different kind of understood ways that respiratory viruses as a genre generically transmit from person to person. But some of those things aren't understood yet specifically about this one, about SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, which is the coronavirus we're talking about. Not only is one of the modes of transmission the kind of large droplets that people will give off when they cough or sneeze, you know, the way that you would catch a cold or the flu, the idea is a mask will stop those. So if you cough, that it'll stop those big droplets, these particles of, you know, snot and spit, basically, that are carrying virus. But it'll also stop smaller expiratory particles, the much smaller, less than half a micron particles that come out apparently when you're talking, when you're exhaling, When you're singing, perhaps, there's still some questions about that. And those behave very differently than those other droplets. So there's some science to try to figure out that the large droplets, you cough them out into the air, and then how far do they spread? That's what that 6 feet social distancing thing is about. People disagree about whether 6 feet is enough or too much or whatever, but that's what that is, that you cough them out and then gravity pulls them down. But these small particles, because they're so small and because they dry out almost immediately when they hit the air, they hang around more. They float around. They behave a little bit like a gas, not completely like a gas. People are going to yell at me about that, but they float in the air. How long and for how much and how much then, how much virus do you need to then take in, and where do you inhale that into your lungs? All these things are still trying to, people are still trying to figure them out. But the idea is that if you're wearing a mask, even a cloth one, a simple cloth one, that it keeps you from giving those particles off as much. It stops some number of them, and so they aren't out there in the world, especially inside where there's no air to blow them away, and keeps them from other people getting them. That's the notion. And the messaging has changed so much there. I mean, Megan and I have both covered three different phases of the messaging that's come from public health experts about this. But the one that I heard that I finally was able to get my head around was better than nothing. Something's better than nothing. And that if some number of people wear a mask some amount of time, that cuts down the amount of infection. And that's what we're trying to do, is get the number of infections below a certain number, because that's how you stop a pandemic.
Right. It seems as though there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding or misperception that if you're wearing a mask, you are protecting yourself. I've heard some people say, well, I went to the grocery store, but I was wearing a mask and gloves, so I'm probably okay. And the whole idea behind a mask, which is I think part of the reason why they've become so complicated and in many ways so politicized and polarizing for people, is that if we collectively all wear them, it's supposed to be for the greater good of public health. It's supposed to be for other people.
You should also check with the local laws and policies, because you may live in a place where it's actually required to wear masks all the time. So just these things change quickly, and you just want to be on top of them.
Next question from Instagram. How long can the virus stay on surfaces?
So this one we know a little bit more about, although, you know, a lot of these experiments have been done in closed lab situations, not necessarily applicable to the real world. But there have been some studies that suggest that the virus can live on surfaces for up to 72 hours and still remain viable. Now, we have also come to, you know, there's been changing science around, you know, what's a bigger deal, transmission from surfaces or transmission through the air. I think, Adam, you were referring to this earlier, where first it was everybody wash your hands, and now it's everyone wear a mask. And some of the scientists I've talked to have mentioned something really interesting, that part of that changing and confusing guidance is related to the fact that it's easier to do experiments about how long stuff stays alive on surfaces. So those were the kinds of experiments that came out first. And now that we're seeing, you know, more studies that are addressing how does the virus live in particles, what size particles, how far do they go, how well do masks work, we're starting to see kind of an evolving guidance that's able to incorporate that, you know, that new science and that new evidence. So, you know, that maybe goes beyond the question, but, you know, I think if you go back to remembering everyone being really freaked out about it, you know, keeping your groceries in your garage for 72 hours, that's where that number came from.
Megan's absolutely right. It's much easier to do that research than it is to do aerosol research. The surface thing, they're called fomites. Those are the surfaces on which viruses can transmit. And the thinking now does seem to be that it's easier to transmit via the air than on surfaces. But the cool thing about washing your hands anyway is that then there seem to also be some indications that numbers for like influenza and colds and other stuff that you do pick up from surfaces, those infection rates went down. So that's good. So keep washing your hands.
Next question. How safe is it to send children to daycare?
As a childless person, I'm going to pass.
Yeah. As a childed person, it seems like the disease does not spread as well to children and among children as it does among adults. It also seems like a more serious disease the older people are. Nobody knows why that is. Children also do seem, when they do get it, to sometimes, very, very rarely, but sometimes get a real weird set of complications that can sometimes be very, very serious on their own. In addition to being a respiratory virus, this disease also seems to have some impacts on circulation and blood and stuff like that. one of the reasons that you close schools at the beginning of a pandemic is, yes, to keep children safe, but also because it then keeps adults home as well. That's punitive, but it's also a public health move. My personal approach to this has been it's probably not safe yet. But also, if you can't earn a living, if you have no childcare, if there's no support for you, if you're trying to parent alone and you can't be in the house, there are other concerns here in addition to the risk of getting COVID-19 that have to be taken into account. We have to understand them and have respect for those issues as well.
And just one thing to add, you know, there are other creative ways around this potentially, rather than sending your child to daycare where they're around lots of other kids and you don't know where those kids have been. If you have another family that lives in your building or your neighborhood, you know, similarly aged kids, is there a way that you can, you know, share childcare and some parents watch all the kids Mondays and Wednesdays and Saturdays and allow parents to both be able to work and really kind of limit the amount of exposure to that one family that you know, make a pact to basically be in each other's germ pods, as I've heard some people call it. Some people call it quarantining. Your quarantine is another family that you kind of agree that you will be in each other's close contacts, but that's it. And you make rules around, you know, who else is allowed in and who's not. So I just wanted to say that, you know, aside from daycare, there are other creative ways that people are trying to figure out this question.
That's a good idea, Megan. Not a bad solution. Inviting another family into your COVID cocoon. We should also note that our Wired colleague Adrian So just wrote a story about this very topic on Wired.com this week, and I recommend that everybody go read it for additional information. Okay, next question. Could short flights be safer than long ones, considering physical distancing? So I think this is a question a lot of people have right now about flying in general, but this is specific to short flights. What do we know about short flights versus long flights?
It's not a crazy construction, because the issue is the way that you do this calculation is the amount of contact you have, but also the time of contact. Shorter flight safer than a longer flight. Flights aren't that safe. Flights only circulate about half. They recirculate about half the air. It's supposed to be HEPA filtered. There are not a lot of examples of outbreaks of any respiratory diseases, much less this one, traced back to airplane flights specifically. But that doesn't mean that it's still not a risk. And it's, again, as Megan has said, there's a calibration of risk levels here, where a short flight's safer than a long flight. If you can avoid flying, it's probably a good time to avoid flying. If you can't, then you wear a mask and you wash your hands and have wipes and you try to follow social distancing rules. So, you know, I think they're not seating people in middle seats anymore. That kind of stuff, I think, is probably a good idea.
However, I will say that short flights tend to be smaller planes, and you may have a higher likelihood that you have a seatmate or a lot of seatmates, and a longer flight, you might be able to avoid that. So it's hard to say, you know, on its face, but those are also things that should go into your consideration.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. It's a good point, Megan.
I think I'm just going to start rolling my luggage around when I take out the garbage, just to feel like I'm going somewhere.
Take a little drive around, but take a backpack and shove it down in between you and the gas pedal and the brake pedal in the car.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
No leg space. I just miss it so much. All right. So restaurants are starting to open up service again, in many cases serving people outdoors. How can we trust restaurants when we eat from outside?
It's not the restaurant's fault to trust the restaurant. What if the restaurant is cooking coronavirus?
These are from Instagram. So
I'd rather have my coronavirus cooked, right?
Yeah, then raw, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, because you really only want to go to a raw virus place that you really trust, that you know that their prep is great. outside's better than inside. Outside's less risky than inside for the reasons of all the how small particles move around in the air. If you're outside, a breeze blows them away. It's less of a risk than being in an enclosed room. The issue is that restaurants operate on such thin margins that they want people to be crowded in there. And also you want them to be crowded because as a source told me this morning, crowded bars are more fun than empty bars. Can you trust that they're like following food safety as much as you trusted them before, you know? And also it's a lot harder to transmit the virus that causes COVID-19 via food than it is all kinds of other stuff that you can get from food. I mean, if you want to panic about food, that's a rabbit hole. Enjoy that. But yeah, it's still where this pandemic is, you want to be outside and you want to be distant from other people. The real risk there is to the people who are, you know, who are stuck in the kitchen together in an enclosed space, or to the wait staff who are working mm-hmm. and having contact with all these other people. Like, this is, now I'm going to be a jerk. It's not just about you, you know?
Right, exactly.
It's about all of us together.
I think you're right, though, in that I think there are so many calculations to do. And one of those is not just your own risk, but the risk that you're exposing other people to, including wait staff. And the other is just how enjoyable is it for you if at this point, you know, you feel like you need to escape the house or escape the apartment, but you go sit outside with your pod and you're all wearing masks and, you know, furiously sanitizing things. And then you go home afterwards and you think, well, you know, I could have patronized that restaurant with takeout and perhaps not exposed other people. It's a really hard thing to decide, I think.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, if you do for your mental health or for whatever reason, you have to go to a restaurant, maybe you could try to do that like once every 2 weeks so that you are trying to be isolated for most of the rest of that time so that, you know, if you did get exposed, that you're not then going on and unwittingly exposing other people. That's one way you could, you know, go out and have your sit down restaurant experience and still be mindful of, you know, the rest of society. You know, like there are ways that you can mitigate the risks of onward transmission. You just have to be thoughtful about it.
Great advice. Okay, so the next question is, should we stay in hotels? Anyone? Anyone from Las Vegas want to weigh in on this one?
I mean, do you have to? Do you have to? I don't know. Like, are you on vacation? Then no, you shouldn't be on vacation. Like, do you have to go to a funeral? I don't know. Like,
I was on a group call with a bunch of fellow journalists, and one of them said that she did end up staying in a hotel recently for reporting purposes, and we were like, what was it like? Is that we had never stayed in a hotel before. Did you wipe everything down? Do you know if anyone had stayed there the night before you? And it was just, yeah, we were incredibly curious about the experience.
It's like we forgot how lucky we were. Or we didn't notice how lucky we were at the time. And now that we don't have it, you know, we remember it. I think that I would avoid a hotel if you can. I think probably being in a hotel room by yourself, especially if you keep the do not disturb up and they don't come in and clean it, is probably safe because you're alone and you're not being exposed to other people. But, I would avoid it. I certainly think that reopening the large casinos, for example, as they are in some places, is asking for a very specific kind of trouble at this point.
At this point, I would like to sit at a hotel bar and have a drink.
God, that is so great, isn't it?
Yes. It's a luxury I took for granted. Next question is, how long do you think it will be until immune-compromised people can safely go out again?
I mean, I think this is one of the questions that there is a lot of research aimed at right now, because I think, you know, what we've been talking about this whole time is people trying to figure out what levels of risks they're comfortable with for themselves. And I'm guessing for the most part, if you're talking about going to hotels and restaurants, you know, you have a pretty healthy immune system, you know, you are maybe worried about what it could mean to get the disease, but you're not in one of these really high risk groups. And, you know, we've been talking about that, we all know the absolute safest thing to do is to stay in our homes forever for the rest of time. But obviously that's not tenable, and it's, you know, going to wear on people's mental health. And that's why we're, you know, talking about how to evaluate these risks, as far as returning to society. And I think for people who are immunocompromised, the real answer is it's not going to be safe until we have something approaching herd immunity. And that could be if we get a vaccine that works, you know, in the next year or the next few years. I mean, we're talking about a long time scale. I mean, I don't want to be a downer, but like, those are the facts.
All right. The final question from our Instagram audience. When I go out for groceries, I always wear pants.
Same.
There's more to the question. Are shorts safe to wear at the store too?
I hope so. I've been wearing shorts. Nothing bad has happened yet.
So let me answer that. I want to answer that in a couple of ways. One way is yes. Another way is what? How do you think this disease is transmitted?
Well, that's why I brought you on, to help people understand. So please help us.
That's not really a mode of egress for the virus.
Okay, so yeah. Shorts are okay. I think people have probably had this question about flip-flops, too, versus closed-toed shoes, versus am I going to bring it in the house? Like, I think in general, this idea of exposure, we keep hearing about exposure, and it manifests itself, it lodges itself into our brains, and then we start thinking of all the ways that we suddenly, just as human beings, feel vulnerable.
That's a great construction, actually, because it is true. All of a sudden, we're forced to confront how we move through the world and what we come into contact with, and how the outside comes into the inside, and what attack surface do we present as physical beings, as biological organisms out in the world, to the things that want to, that can do us harm. Yeah, that's all scary stuff when you start to think about it. Welcome to the Monday morning meeting at the science desk.
I think we should rename our desk to just like Apocalypse Beat.
All right. Those were some great questions from our Instagram audience. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to ask some questions that our Wired colleagues sent in. And I have one of my own.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Each episode features insight you won't find anywhere else from the center of the conversation surrounding emerging technologies like AI. Right now on the podcast, you can hear a special episode where Brad Smith lays out Microsoft's vision for a vibrant marketplace driving the new AI economy. To hear more, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Welcome back. All right, this time the questions are coming from inside the house. We solicited some questions from our Wired colleagues. Some of them wrote them in, some of them declined to be named, and some of them actually sent in some voice notes. So we're going to get right to it. Here is our first question.
Hi, this is Scott Gilbertson, Wired staff writer on the Gear team. My question is about flying. Is it safe for my parents to fly across the country to visit their grandkids? And what, if anything, can we do to mitigate whatever risks do exist?
So I can take this one. And I'm going to say, I think a lot of these questions coming from our colleagues are some variation of, will you please give me permission to do this thing I want to do? And I'm just saying flat out that, like, I'm not going to do that. These are decisions you are going to have to make for yourselves in terms of evaluating the risk. But I will say that, you know, all the guidance we're getting from CDC and other World Health Organizations are encouraging people to travel only when essential, urgent, and necessary. And if all you're trying to do is get your family together for, you know, a family visit or a family reunion, I think that that probably does not fall under that category. So I just want to stress again that any unnecessary travel is creating risk, not just for you and your family, but for everyone that they might meet along the way, in the airport, on the airplane, in the taxi ride, like whatever it is. There are ways to mitigate the risks, but there's no way to get to zero risk. And so I think you just have to ask yourself, is that going to be worth it? And also, what health are your parents in? Do you want to be the reason that, you know, do you want to be the reason that they don't make it? I don't know. I know that's grim, but these are conversations I've had to have with my own family who's been asking me nonstop, can I go visit my grandchildren? Can I go do this? And We've had to have some really difficult talks. I won't kid you.
Next question. How do I convince my family to wear masks when we see each other in the future? And if we're wearing masks, does it matter if occasionally we're less than 6 feet apart?
I'll just reiterate what Megan said in that, you know, we can't give permission to people to engage in risky behaviors, especially when by dint of asking these questions, they probably recognize the behavior is sort of riskier. But that said, none of us is perfect. Our masks all slip sometimes, both metaphorically and literally. And, you know, you want to be cautious. I'm not sure how to convince family members of anything. Because it's not like showing people the science helps. I think we've all learned that. Maybe some of the things that we've been saying here about what the point of the mask is, that the point of the mask is not perfection. None of us expects perfection of any of ourselves. The point of the mask is to reduce, is to mitigate those risks. So like, did the mask slip and you got within 6 feet of each other like that one time? Try not to do that. That's the idea. Try not to do that. Were you outside and not wearing masks? Okay, that's good. You know, were you farther apart? Yeah, good. That's how it's supposed to be. This is all difficult. People are starting to go nuts about it. And that's people who aren't forced to, you know, go out and do hard jobs, essential jobs every day. It's just those of us who have been confined at home. We're getting a little stir crazy. So we try to be forgiving of all of that, with in mind that, like, every time you do it, you increase risk a little bit and you should try to mitigate that.
Here is our next question. How long should I wait to get tested after going to a protest or other crowded event?
I can take this one. I'm in Minneapolis, where there have been a lot of protests and crowded events of all kinds. And the city has started to set up some free testing clinics around town. And they are recommending that people come and get tested within 3 to 7 days of when they were exposed to a large group of people. You don't want to go too soon, because if you have been exposed to the virus, and it doesn't have enough time to, you know, kind of replicate enough that the test can pick it up. So we think the incubation is somewhere between 3 and 14 days, with a median around 5 to 7. So if you can go in that window, you'll have the greatest chance of getting an accurate read on whether or not you have been infected.
We already addressed some of this in the first part of the show, but this next question comes from our colleague Indu, and she sent in her question.
Hey everyone, this is Indu. I'm WIRED's Director of Audience Development. My question is about the Bay Area. We're now required to wear a mask within 30 feet of someone. Is this really necessary, or are they just priming us psychologically to be ready to wear masks always and forever?
Well, this is the complicated calculation that public health experts always have to make, which is, with limited information, how can you induce the safest behaviors by the most people for the longest amount of time, knowing that it won't always work? So if you tell people to wear masks within 30 feet, then a lot of people will try to do that. And that will be safer than nobody doing it. And when the people fail to do it and they get within 15 or something, that's also a little bit safer than if they're within 3 feet, right? So you can imagine, and that's not, so these aren't lies. It's not nefarious. It's an attempt to take incomplete information and apply it to a large population of people with different needs and different abilities to do what you want them to be able to do. Are they trying to prepare us to wear masks forever and always? You know, there's the argument that cultures in which wearing masks outdoors, where that was already kind of normed, did better with how COVID-19 spread than cultures where it didn't. Those arguments have a lot of problems, and you can guess what some of them are. They conflate a lot of things. There's some race implications there but the fact is that there are places where that was always okay, and it hasn't been okay in the United States, and I think it's going to be okay from now on. A societal shift has happened, a cultural shift has happened, where we wear masks outside, and going forward, probably if you don't feel that well, you wear a mask. And if we want to start using public transit again, it's probably a good idea to be wearing masks. And public transit is going to be really important going forward too, because we don't want to screw up cities with climate and congestion and all kinds of other public health things. So yeah, I think masks are part of what we do culturally now.
All right, here's a long question from another one of our WIRED colleagues who did not want to be named. And I'm going to condense this a little bit. She says, I am my sister's maid of honor in her upcoming wedding, and the pandemic has created an incredibly tense situation for us. She originally planned a destination bachelorette party for her sister. It was going to involve 10 friends. It was this summer. As the date grew closer, they decided to cancel it. But then shortly after canceling it, her sister decided that she did want to go ahead with this destination bachelorette party. And she's asked this, our friend, to reschedule a new trip for the same month. She's really not comfortable with this idea of planning a trip for 10 people that involves air travel, staying in a shared accommodation. Also, the staffer lives in New York City, which was a COVID hotspot. She talks about this in her question to us. She also is aware that perhaps her sister and some of the other people involved in this potential party have been traveling around and maybe not always social distancing. So there's this excruciating back and forth that's going on. And her family has kind of done like, it seems like her family has been a little bit passive in it, you know, saying, oh, it's just a disagreement and there's no right or wrong. So she is now trying to rationalize whether or not she could possibly go to this bachelorette party and still be a responsible human being. And she ends the question with help. What are your thoughts on this?
What a mess.
I mean, I think it's incredibly unfortunate to be put in that position, especially when there is enough science to be able to say, you know, say some things.
There is a right or wrong. They shouldn't have the party. We should say that. That's like the risk. That is a group of people getting together for a long period of time in close quarters. That's exactly the risk. Those are where the outbreaks have been. So we should stipulate that. The question is whether that risk is counterbalanced by, you know, not wanting your sister to think that you don't love her.
Yeah.
Have I summed that up right?
Yeah, that's it.
Well, you think about, you know, the graduations and graduation parties that didn't happen. All of the kind of markers of transition and change that we rely on to be part of our lives and indicate to be with people that we love and show that we respect and care about each other and that the time is moving, that all had to not happen. And it's a weight, and it's a real emotional weight, in the same way as the more apparent weight of the 115,000 deaths in the United States already, and the people who've been sick and who are going to be disabled, and all of the other things that this has caused. We can't minimize those losses. But at the same time, this is an emotional response, not a scientific one. Those are the things that should make us be coming together and being more resolute in the fact that because there are no drugs and no vaccines, that we're supposed to be helping each other and caring for each other more in weird new ways. So I'm being pretty adamant, I guess, about like bachelorette parties here as a thing that is a necessary sacrifice. But if it blows up a family, is that cost too high? I don't know.
You know, the thing about this pandemic is that everyone is making sacrifices, and when we see other people, you know, breaking that social contract and maybe not making the same sacrifice, I think the knee-jerk response is to say, oh, hey, but like they're doing that, like they're like, why can't I do my thing? And I think Adam's absolutely right that this is a time where we need to see that and say, no, I'm going to like take extra care because I'm maybe not seeing that reflected, and I need to set an example, and not just set an example, but actually by making that sacrifice, you are, you know, reducing potentially dozens or, you know, hundreds of potential strains of transmission if we're talking about multiple people flying from all over the country to, I mean, bachelorette parties are, you know, you go out and you drink and you do things that then cloud your ability to, you know, assess the riskiness of that behavior. It's just, it seems like there can only be one answer. But again, I think when it comes to family, there's no easy answers.
And I promise to still respect and care for my colleague, whichever decision she makes here.
Right. And it's hard to communicate those answers, too. One of you said earlier, can you change your family's mind about anything? And so there are certain ways in which you may try to communicate what your concerns are, and they may come across as sanctimonious, and then you're not really getting through to anybody. So it seems like in those cases that you do have to find ways to lead by example or show that you care In some ways, showing that you care these days is not showing up, which is hard to grapple with. Okay, this last question comes from our colleague Jay. He also sent in a voice note, so let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Jay, and I'm the Director of Editorial Operations at Wired. So here's my question. My gym was super gross to begin with, and I doubt it'll be any better once the pandemic is over. I frankly doubt I'm ever going to go back. So in the meantime, I've taken up running. But on my run today, of the 15 or so runners or cyclists who breezed past me, only 3 were wearing masks. I mean, I get it. I wear a mask. I know how inconvenient they can be. My glasses steam up. I feel like I can't get enough oxygen. I have to smell my own breath. I actually brush my teeth before I run. But I wear a mask as much for my own safety as well as for the safety of others. Am I being overly cautious? Is it okay to do cardio outside on the street without a mask?
It does seem like it's really hard to transmit the infection by running past somebody else, even if you're breathing hard. Because if you're outside, those small particles don't seem to get from the person who may be infected and who isn't showing symptoms yet. Because presumably if you're symptomatic, you're not out running. So this is either if you're asymptomatic, which is to say you're sick, but don't have any symptoms, or you're pre-symptomatic, which is you've been infected and you aren't showing symptoms yet, so you still feel good enough to go out for a run. That the number of times that happens, times the number of times that you come into contact with somebody like that, times the amount of virus that you put out, times the cloud that you'd have to run through and inhale, all those things seem very, very rare. I think it's a good practice, if possible, to wear the mask outside, because we should be learning to do that. I think the transmissions of running past somebody are vanishingly rare. At this point, much safer than going to the gym, for example, which is opening, which I think is still probably something that if you can avoid, you should probably avoid for all the same reasons. But how mad should you be at some other jogger for not wearing a mask? I mean, that's maybe not where we live yet either, where we're policing those sorts of behaviors in that situation. Being in the supermarket and asking somebody to put a mask on, I think is more significant. I don't know, Megan, do you have a different view on that?
No, I mean, the only nuance I would add is that, you know, where you run, you know, you may want to, you know, consider different behaviors if you, you know, are on a crowded, you know, jogging path or other throughway in a city and everyone else is there because they also can't go to their gyms. You know, that might be, again, a situation where you'd want to wear a mask.
All right. I have a quick personal question for you both to end the question round. So last year, I consciously uncoupled after a very long partnership, and near the end of the year, I moved into a new place, and, you know, then 2020 happened, and now I'm wondering if I'll ever date again. Okay, that's very dramatic, but I am wondering about dating and how people are supposed to date. So I've heard that in dating apps that now there's a lot of suggestion that people, and nudges that people video chat. I do know some people have gone for socially distant walks and that sort of thing. But what do you really see as the future of dating here? Because there was this New York Times graphic this week where the New York Times surveyed more than 500 epidemiologists about the things they would do and wouldn't do. And 42% of them said they would wait more than a year before meeting new people, which was really disheartening to read. So what are your thoughts on that?
I've been with the same partner living with the person for 25 years, so I don't think I would know how to answer a question about dating that didn't happen in a year where there was a pandemic.
Okay, well, way to throw a gal under the bus, Adam.
I'm useless here. That's all. I'm embarrassed how useless I am here.
I've also been living with the same person for a number of years, but I do have younger
siblings.
Guys,
I was in your boat just a short while ago. My timing is impeccable.
I'm going to say a few things I've heard of people doing, and then maybe we can do the thought experiment of what we ourselves would do. You know, I have younger friends who have been, you know, on the online apps, and they have been setting up video calls, and I have... So my sister actually does this kind of funny thing where the first date is always some version of one person gives a TED talk about whatever they want, because it's kind of like, well, if this sucks, at least, like, I learned about this thing, or, like, we don't have to make weird, dribble-ish, like, first date commentary over, video. I don't really know what the next step is, because I'm not sure there have been a lot of instant chemistry. And I hope she doesn't mind me sharing.
No, I have to say I'm not surprised there haven't been a ton of follow-ups after that formula.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'll just say I do not envy you or anyone else in that situation. And actually, Lauren, I've been thinking about you a lot and how like anxious and how full of anxiety I would be if I was having to make all of these decisions on my own. So I feel for you.
Thanks, Megan.
Yeah, I don't know. How would I? It's weird because, I mean, I never did any online dating in pre-pandemic times. So if I were to start doing that, it would just be, I don't know, I might just become a hermit. It just sounds so overwhelming.
I mean, there is a lot of time to focus on personal growth, which is something that you kind of hope for post-relationship anyway. But I think that there's a real risk of becoming too inward when the point is right now, I think that you're also supposed to find ways to help people and connect with people and reach out to other people. And it's really hard when you feel hamstrung in making those connections. I've seen some articles, I think The Economist wrote one about how like the emotional connection is back in and sex is out. It's like, well, yeah, like people's hands are forced, but also like, no, I mean, so like, are we supposed to start writing love letters? Like, should I be expecting notes via pigeon? I don't know.
To go back to the concept of a, you know, of a germ pod, if you were to meet someone, you know, through an online dating app, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with going out and instead of going to get a drink at a bar, you go and you go for a, you know, a socially distanced walk. And maybe after a few of those, you realize, I want to keep seeing this person. And then you wind up having to, do a pandemic age define the relationship talk about if you want to be in each other's germ pod. And you know, there's a lot that goes into that in terms of being transparent about how often the other person is going shopping, how many other people they're seeing, you know, like you want to get on the same level in terms of what amount of risk you're comfortable with. But I think, so it might accelerate or decelerate relationships in that sense. But I think there's no reason if you have, you know, a genuine connection with someone that you could, you know, make that decision to explore the relationship more physically in a way that feels safe by having those kinds of conversations.
Because it cuts off all the ways that we have to keep in touch with people who are not, you know, who don't share homes with now, all cut off the bandwidth, the frequencies in relationship bandwidth that are so important to a romantic connection. They cut off a lot of socio-emotional cues because Zoom can't handle that. They cut off spontaneity. They cut off all of the ways that you build partnership with somebody are the things that, you know, a phone call or a video conference are not great at. And they're okay at maintaining them. Maybe if you already had it, you can find ways to hold on to them if they pre-exist. But to build them now going forward, it does seem like you'd have to find a way to be in person with a person at least for a while. And I think that this is one of those things where like we can identify what riskier levels of risk and behaviors are, and you can decide which ones are going to be are that you're going to assume in a given situation. One of the ways that like when people try to understand, public health folks try to understand why Japan seems to have dealt with the pandemic better than other places, one of the things that one of the ideas here is that they communicated the risk very differently. They didn't do what like the United States did and say, okay, always masks, wash your hands, be 6 feet apart, don't be in crowds ever, close all the schools, no mass gathering events. What instead they did is they kept doing most of that stuff, but they said, here's what the risks are, and here's, so try not to do these things, especially together. You know, try not to talk to somebody really close up for a long time. Try not to be in a crowded room with a lot of people for a long time. Try not to, all the stuff that we understand are risky. Acknowledging that like they all kind of cross over with each other. And so I would say that the here's my guess. It's a guess. I'm not going to be expert in this, but the risk of being alone to the point where it hurts a lot for people is probably, that risk is greater than a risk of like, okay, you went outside and sat with somebody at the other end of a picnic table for a while and tried to get to know them. That has its own kind of risks as well, but maybe sometimes those are worth it too.
Well, thank you to both of you for answering so thoughtfully. And it seems as though my initial assessment was correct and that I am never going to date again. I'm obviously kidding, but it does seem as though we're entering a completely new era of social interaction. And I'll keep you updated as I navigate it. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll do very quick recommendations.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston. And on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click Here. Stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine
ignition.
Click here.
And liftoff.
Click here every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, time for recommendations. Megan, would you like to go first?
Sure. So this one's a little bit weird. It's actually an audio book. I don't listen to these very often, but kind of relevant to our conversation, I recently had to travel to Atlanta to take care of a ailing family member, and in an effort to, they're an immunocompromised person, so in an effort to minimize risk, my partner and I did the whole 17-hour drive in one shot, with only stops at, like, parks for outdoor eating. Anyways, but we listened to this book called Little Eyes, which is by the Argentinian author Samantha Schweblin, who is this just amazing kind of surrealistic style of writing. I had read her 2017 debut novella, which is called Fever Dream, which was just wild and kind of messed me up for a while. But her new book is actually this kind of thought experiment on what would happen if an individual could be virtually inserted into the life of a random stranger anywhere in the world. And kind of the vehicle for this is these little creatures. They feel like they would, if they were real, like we would be covering the heck out of them at Wired. They're called Kintukis. And imagine like a cross between a teddy bear and a cell phone with legs that has a connection to one other person in the world inside of it. And you don't know who they are and you don't know anything about them. And you have to keep the Kintuki charged. And if you don't, the connection is cut and you lose track of each other forever. Anyways, it is wild, and it has given me all sorts of things to think about in terms of the way we think about the future at Wired, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. And the audiobook is great. The woman who reads it is fantastic, and she does accents amazingly. So yeah, it's great.
That sounds super interesting. Thank you for that recommendation, Megan. Adam, what's yours?
We spun up HBO Max in my house via our cable and internet subscription, and it has it's like the 57th streaming service that we have for some reason, but it's divided into a bunch of channels. One of the channels is Turner Classic Movies, TCM, which means it's like this whole Warner Brothers back catalog. So the other night I turned on a movie called Footlight Parade, which is James Cagney's first song and dance movie from 1933, and it's with like these delirious psychedelic Busby Berkeley dance numbers with all like 300 scantily clad women in swimming pools sliding down water slides and all these really racy pre-code jokes and Cagney, everybody with all the acting is really weird. Early 30s, you know, they're like still learning how to do talkies basically, except for Cagney, who's magnetic and a movie star. And you're like, oh, well, that's why he got to be famous. And I stayed up until like 1 a.m. watching this movie till the end of it, because I stay up too late now because, you know, things are things. But also I realized, like, God, I'm sitting here watching a 100-year-old movie right now instead of like trying to pay attention to what's happening or work or whatever. I can't, like, why am I doing this? And I, as my partner was going to bed finally, was like, I'm good not seeing how this ends. I'm sure it's happy. And I was like, I can't, what am I doing? And the answer is like trying to be okay, trying to have something that feels better. And you know, I'm watching a 100-year-old movie because 100 years ago, things were different. Like, they had gotten through the Spanish flu in 1918, and they were trying to deal with feeling bad about the Depression by having these beautiful dance numbers. And there was no such thing as World War II. They had no idea what was coming. It was a moment that I think fit like a puzzle piece into a very specific place in my head. And also, the movie's pretty good and the dance numbers are amazing.
And you watched that on HBO Max, you said?
I did, yes.
All right, which is, I think, $14.99 per month, if I'm not mistaken.
Holy smoke, I'm glad it comes with cable.
I think it is. I think I know this because I recently resubscribed to the HBO app. So now I have HBO Max on my iPad because I wanted to watch Run, which is my recommendation. It's a new series created by Vicky Jones. The executive producer is Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who many of you may know from Fleabag. It stars Merritt Weaver and Donald Gleeson. And it is this zany runaway romance where the two main characters made an agreement many years ago when they were dating in college that if things in the real world ever got to be too much in the future and they texted each other run and the other one responded with run, it meant that they were going to run away together. And throughout the years, they had each texted each other, but the other wouldn't respond. And in this case, they're both at a point in their lives, in their late 30s, where they say, like, fuck it, we're running. And so they get on a train going cross country. One of the characters first flies from the West Coast to the East Coast and does the thing where she runs up to the desk at the airport and slaps her car down and is like, get me a ticket. And I'm like, oh my God, that sounds so fun right now. I would love to do that. And there's no mask or hand sanitizer or mental gymnastics about will I die. And then... So she goes and they meet on a train and then they're going westward. It's funny. It's zany. I really enjoyed it. It was a nice, you know, bit of escapism, certainly. As you kind of noted, Adam, there's this thing about watching shows or movies from the before times where now all these interactions seem like we took them for granted. There are characters making out. They're using the train bathroom without worrying about things. In fact, one of them rips the handle off a train bathroom door and then later makes a joke about germs. I just really enjoyed it and I recommend it. So that's Run on HBO. All right, that's our very long show for this week. We hope you found it helpful. Thank you for listening. And thank you to Megan and Adam for joining me.
Thanks, Lauren.
It's always a pleasure to get to talk to you.
And thank you to everybody who submitted questions. If you have feedback, you can find all of us on Twitter. Just check the show notes for our handles. The show is produced by Boone Ashworth, and our executive producer is Alex Kappelman. We'll be back next week, and until then, stay healthy.
Want a new podcast to look forward to each week? One that's entertaining, informative, and packed with actionable content? Come on, of course you do. Introducing the Jordan Harbinger Show. The Jordan Harbinger Show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Jordan dives into the minds of fascinating people, from athletes, authors, and scientists, to mobsters, spies, and hostage negotiators. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R, B as in boy, I, N as in Nancy, G-E-R, in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. From PRX.